and welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic physician, herbalist, and host of the program today. Really excited to talk about a little about history today. One of my favorite subjects being that I teach history of naturopathic and natural medicine at the University of Bridgeport College of Naturopathic Medicine, one of the institutions that I helped found here on the East Coast. And I'm really excited to have Dr. Ed Alstead on from Eclectic Institute. And last year, I think, Eclectic Institute celebrated their 30th anniversary. And they've evolved into a fully integrated herbal and nutritional company which maintains its roots and expertise in naturopathic medicine. Dr. Alstead, he's the founder of Eclectic, and he began his career as a pharmacist and continues education and training as a naturopathic physician. And while he was studying at the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, he looked into the history of the Eclectic Medical Schools, who we're going to be talking about in depth today, a dominant force in the evolution of American medicine from the 1830s to 1930, about 100 years. And he researched and studied a lot of the therapies used by the Eclectic physicians and those formulated by John Uri Lloyd and Dr. Felter and Dr. Scudder, all Eclectic pharmacists, professors, and inventors. And then he wanted to get into that and pursue that in his own ventures, and he began to continue in that vein and bring Eclectic medicine into this century. So we're really excited to have him on the show and talk about things like that in the history particularly. Dr. Alstead, are you there?
I'm here, Eugene. Thank you.
Hey, good to hear from you. I'm really excited to do this because, you know, when I teach naturopathic history, we spend quite a bit of time talking about the Eclectic movement and how it kind of began and how the Eclectic doctors came from the physiomedicalists and other herbalists there. And really, for being a long time ago, really evolved and developed a huge number of books and writings and followings and schools. It was just amazing. And this is often a forgotten part of history. And I think it's up to folks like yourself and myself to kind of keep it going. Can you give us a little bit of background and more depth about that movement in the country?
Well, I think you gave a good summary of the years that elapsed since that time. So I think mostly what we have done is reprint a lot of the books that you mentioned from the Eclectics, and that had turned into a project that a lot of people have been appreciative of seeing the information, because there are literally volumes and volumes of books that are well written that are still the number one books for most herbal, botanical, naturopathic doctors to acquire these books from the early 1900s and have them in their library. So I've found that from being a pharmacist, when I first discovered these books available at the naturopathic college that I was attending, that they were really important to be reprinted and distributed as much as possible. So we currently have sold a lot of them in hard copy, and now they're also available on audiobook, well, not audiobooks, but printed books that you can download.
So, you know, when you go back in history, it turns out, and, you know, when I'm lecturing, it turns out that there were several types of medical doctors way back in the 1800s, and so there were the hydropaths, which Russell Trowell kind of led the pack of those doctors, and these were doctors that believed in fasting and led to nature cure and things like that. You had an outgrowth of homeopathic medical doctors, that used homeopathy, you know, practically exclusively. Famous doctor that people may have heard of would be Constantine Hering and, you know, Boricke and things, people like that. Then you had the eclectic doctors who were medical doctors too, and then of course the straight allopathic physicians. Now they were called heroic doctors. Why? What does that mean? And put that in context with those early movements of MDs at the at that time.
You're getting into a realm of information that one colleague of mine, we graduated from the Naturopathic College on the same year and have become connected constantly by HIP, I would say, Dr. Francis Brinker.
Mm.
And he has been working with Eclectic ever since day one in reprinting and following a lot of the Eclectics. And I had asked him if he could possibly, you know, be available to discuss some of the details of the history of the eclectic physicians himself, because he's more versed in it. My background is really having grown up in southern Illinois, and my grandparents being farmers, I think I must have inherited a lot of that interest in farming. And so I went to pharmacy school in St. Louis, Missouri, kind of mixing up the concept of the idea of what pharmacy or farming might be. And so after being a pharmacist for a number of years, I finally realized, maybe I could do better by going back to a different college where I might learn more about herbs and vitamins and so mm-hmm. on. And so that's when I discovered the Naturopathic College and then have migrated toward that and really, really kind of focused so much on all the aspects of botanical medicine, mm-hmm. which the eclectics were very versed in, that that now I think I spend most of my time as a farmer and less of it as a historian.
Okay, great. Well, me too. I was just out in the garden before you called because, you know, we're in a serious heat wave here on the East Coast here, so everything needs a little water. And I have, you know, I'm the curator of the botanical garden at the University of Bridgeport, where we have several hundred species of medicinal herbs. So we'll talk a little bit about that and maybe some of the herbs that the eclectics used, and you could talk a little bit about your knowledge of these botanicals too. I always remember when I was in school, you wrote a great article on antivirals and how plants can act as antivirals, and you actually had a nice diagram of how the different plants can act as direct and indirect antivirals. And I still use that information when I teach here to the East Coast naturopathic group. So, you know, maybe we could talk about that. You know, people here on the East Coast, we've had so much rain, Dr. Alsted, that people are starting to get West Nile virus and Eastern equine encephalitis from the mosquito bites, which are viral diseases. Allopathic medicine really doesn't really have tremendous variety of antivirals out there. Are there any naturopathic antivirals that you see work that the Eclectic Institute has done some work in bringing into fruition?
Well, one of the most interesting ones was what we call Lomatium, which it actually grows here in Oregon on the not far from Portland on the river. And that actually came from whenever there was this worldwide influenza epidemic in the United States, well, all over the world in 1912, during that time. And Ernest Krebs Sr. was in one of the people who had looked into this herb that was being used by the Native American Indians. And they were one of the few people in the country that were surviving this worldwide pandemic. And then it was used extensively, and he brought it into California and started producing it, and it became a very big product, and was never, after that 3 or 4 years and where that passed, it never really became a bigger product in anywhere that I had seen. And when I found out about it, I had called Dr. Krebs on the phone. Dr. Krebs, the younger Dr. Krebs now, because the other one had passed away. So I called him, and he said, well, he told me how to get the herb, how to process it. And so being a pharmacist, I was taking notes while he was talking to me on the phone. And I was actually at the college at that time, working as a doctor then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd written this information down, and I went to the lab, and I processed it the way he said. And when I got done, it was that yellow color he mentioned. So I called him. He said, well, that's unusual, because he said, I've never found anybody else that could do it. But I said, well, I just followed your directions, because I followed what you asked me, and I wrote it out. And then we started using it in the naturopathic profession, and it was working. It worked very well, and there was a significant amount of conditions that it had. Epstein-Barr was just coming out, the EBV virus, and so on. So I've used that extensively for helping with that condition, and it's been really successful.
And it's interesting that Lomatium's in the whole carrot family that I think they used to call it the umbelliferae, but now they call it the Apiaceae family. So that has some of those antiviral coumarins and other compounds, I believe, in there that seem to. Does it actually attack the virus, or how did you figure out that the Lomatium works?
Well, it took a lot of work, because at that time with EBV it was very interesting. So this one lady down there in Texas had this condition, and I had asked her to use it and early on, and she got significant relief from it and had worked with other physicians in the area. And she became an advocate of the product and started talking to people more about it. And then, as always, things like this, one thing leads to another, and eventually I had acquired enough people who had interest in it that if they would follow my directions on how to use it, I would supply them with it for my own interest in trying to find out if it would continue to be effective. And it's very time consuming to treat that condition, but in the end, the Lomatium worked very well.
Yeah.
And
what about Echinacea? That was a pretty important plant back in the eclectic days, and I think that they were possibly one of the first of the doctors to take that Native American information and apply it to a large group of patients and get a lot of clinical data on Echinacea. I know eventually it spread to Germany, and they had their own extraction procedures and their own kind of work, body of work around Echinacea. But I know that's a very important plant in eclectic medicine, and we owe a lot to them for bringing that plant. It's kind of ironic that over 100 years late, it was very popular 100 years ago, and then, like all natural medicine, fell out of favor, and then all of a sudden it had a renaissance, like many herbs, 100 years later, which I find fascinating. Tell us a little bit about Echinacea.
Well, it's kind of interesting that this was, the eclectics were all from the era around Cincinnati, Ohio, and that's where the Lloyd Library is currently located, and that's where John Uri Lloyd, as you mentioned, had his company, his business, and he was basically a pharmacist as well. And you can go to the Lloyd Library, and it's number, I think, six on the list of libraries to be saved in case of a national disaster, because it is so full of archives of important medical textbooks. And if you go there to look, you can look at the books, but you have to ask for them, and then they bring them down, and you have to open them up there inside the library. You can't take them out. And then, so when John Uri Lloyd was doing his work, he was starting to locate some of this echinacea out of north the Dakotas mostly, and then they would bring it in. And of course, you have to, the thing about a lot of these herb things is you have to realize that they're not in the same century, in the same time, and in the same genre of getting these materials. So I have to assume that a lot of times, you know, they were put on trains, they were loaded up dry, and then they were shipped in, and they didn't really grow there in Cincinnati. So they were using material that they would collect and then be brought in, and had eventually had very large processing plants there in Cincinnati. And the eclectics were, at the time, in the schools that they were graduating the doctors, they were the largest profession of practitioners in the United States.
Mm.
There were more colleges that were promoting doctors who were practicing medicine and as physicians than anyone at the time. So botanical medicine was a very important part, and of course echinacea became one of the biggest herbs in the eclectic regimen, eclectic angustifolia, from the Dakotas. And then as Europe began to bring in echinacea, they got it mainly from the United States is where it started. And now it's come, you know, it's become a big product in Europe too. But it is an American herb. So that's how important, at least you can see it spreading, as eventually Europe became one of the bigger botanical areas and one of the stronger points as the eclectic profession sort of faded out with the changes in the regulations. And we kind of lost our momentum until recently when naturopathic medicine started up again here. Well, I was one of the early classes, as you were, too.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that they, you know, looked at this. I always laugh at the supposedly funny story behind, you know, the guy that tried to get the eclectics to use echinacea. Supposedly it was a snake bite remedy, and he supposedly volunteered to be bit by a snake to show its efficacy. But it seemed like a lot of people believed in that. But back then there were a lot of, you know, there weren't a lot of regulations with botanicals, and there were a lot of snake oil salesmen, you know, that would pull up into town and, you know, peddle their wares and hawk their botanicals. But, you know, I found from reading that the eclectics really tried to reel that in, and they tried to do standardization and create, you know, like Scooter's specific medicines. You know, Scooter was another one that I think is worth mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
And Felter. I'm looking at his book right now, H.W. Felter.
Yeah.
These were people that wrote extensively about these plants, and I love the clinical information. You know, a lot of times in this day and age, people poo-poo the clinical stuff. They're like, okay, where's the double-blind studies? Where's this? But I find that another evidence-based, quote-unquote, is the incredible notes that the doctors took when they used these plants on people and people's reactions and how fast they got better and the dosing and all kinds of things like that was very specific to the eclectics. Any comments on that, Dr. Alsted?
Well, over the 30 years that I've had eclectic, I've spent a lot of time looking into all that information that you're bringing up, and it's amazing how effective these materials were, and that's really was almost the mainstream of medicine in those days in the United States, and it's starting to have a revival again, and a strong revival, and the herbs have not diminished. We're learning more and more about their effectiveness, and there's so much information available that it's hard to know it all, even today. And
yeah.
But I can't think of hardly any plant out there that we haven't learned as naturopathic physicians to kind of be effective for almost a myriad of conditions. And we keep looking for some of these magic bullet kind of things when, in fact, most of the plant material is effective just as food. And it doesn't have to be something that you have to wait till you get sick to take. And this is kind of part of how it all emerged. Eventually, it got into pharmacy that the Lloyd brothers had and extractions and was sold in Ohio, where a lot of the eclectics were, extensively. So I don't have any plant that I can think of that is my favorite or that I would say doesn't have a good effect. And one of them, and sort of a little bit of, as an aside, to go from the eclectics to currently to the Eclectic Institute, is that one of the things that we found to be most effective was never discovered by the eclectics at the time, is the common plant called stinging nettles, which probably a lot of people have heard of.
Mm.
And in that one, we had started a project where we were thinking about freeze-drying some herbs. It was the first time. And so we sent this, we went and collected. The only thing that was up was stinging nettles in March or April here in Oregon. So we went and collected some of the nettles, put it in a envelope and sent it to this company in California and asked them to freeze-dry it fresh and then just to send it back once they freeze-dried it. And so they sent it back and they put it in capsules. Well, we didn't have any use for stinging nettles that was dried in capsules, but as it turned out, by mistake, our business manager was having allergies that month, and he took the nettles by accident. He was supposed to be taking the echinacea that was also sent, but instead he took the nettles, and his allergies went away.
Uh-huh.
Nobody knew that nettles had the effect on allergies. So that has become our biggest product that we sell currently.
Wow.
Simply because it works so effectively and it doesn't have any side effects and so forth. So we're still, you know, evolving and learning a lot about these plant materials, and echinacea, you know, almost if you go into any health food store and ask if you've got a cold or flu or anything like that, almost everyone that works in the store would say, oh, take echinacea. That's become so prevalent now that it's commonly used. And allergies, nettles, freeze-dried nettles, is almost becoming the same sort of category during the summertime when people are suffering from allergies. So we're still learning a lot about this medicine, and it's not just the historical components. It's also the current activity. And the eclectics used a lot of extraction processes, so that they did like you would go and get the herb dried usually, and then get alcohol and water and mix them together and form an extract, which is fairly common. And that product is now sold in a lot of health food stores as an herbal extract. But there's also methods of freeze-drying that we do that are just the fresh herbs that are then freeze-dried. And those things carry different properties when they're fresh or freeze-dried versus dried and extracted. So we're still investigating the properties of echinacea, and not just the ones that the eclectics brought in through the extraction process, but in its fresh form. And there's also more species of echinacea now growing. There's one in Tennessee called Echinacea tennesseensis, which only grows in this country, and it's very strong and very tingly, and has a tingling aspect. And it was on the endangered plant list, but it's now been taken off the list, and that's another one that we cultivate. So kind of wandering through this myriad of questions you might be asking, but there's so much to cover that it's hard to point out anything without giving a history of how much is going on.
I found it fascinating that the eclectics talked a lot about echinacea as a topical. I mean, I'm looking at page 348 in Dr. Felter's book, and he goes on and on about applying it to sterile gauze and putting it for all kinds of bites and discharges and sores, bed sores, he says, tibial ulcers, just as to clean wounds. I mean, it's a mouthwash for problems with spongy and bleeding gums. I mean, it's amazing. And this is, you know, a lot of this information never really percolates down to the consumer. When I tell them, oh, yeah, you could use echinacea instead of using hydrogen peroxide or something like that, or to stimulate wound healing if you have a diabetic that has a bad wound or whatnot, they look at me like, really? I didn't know you could use these things topically. That's the rich information that the eclectics gave us if people would, you know, read the books, and you made these available to everyone, which was really a wonderful, wonderful thing. You know, we're going to take a break. I'm looking at the time. It's a half hour. Let's take a break, and then if the engineers listen, maybe we could put on one of our natural medicine chests too, so we could do some station IDs and maybe one of our natural medicine chest, a little mini modular program that myself and Dr. Kamai produce. And we'll be back with more with Dr. Alsted and Eclectic Medicine, and talk a lot bit more about herbs and growing herbs and things like that when we return. So stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network. Well, I hear the music, and I guess that means we're coming back here with the natural nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, and we're here with Dr. Ed Alsted from Eclectic Institute. And Eclectic Institute celebrated their 30 years as a company, and they have evolved into a fully integrated herbal and nutritional company, which maintains their roots and expertise in naturopathic medicine with an emphasis on the eclectic body of knowledge that doctors, as we've been talking about, if you heard the first half of the program, doctors have been discussing this stuff since the 1800s. And we're bringing this knowledge back so that you, the listener, can be aware of these things. Welcome back, Dr. Alsted.
Thank you.
Let's talk about, you know, stress is one of those things that we as society seems to be very pervasive. So, you know, I'm wondering what herbs that you like to give to your patients or have designed for stress or what herbal formulas you find seem to help people deal with that. I mean, it's interesting. I'm actually doing a talk at one of the big conferences, the Restorative Medicine Conference in San Diego in the fall, and I'm looking, and my topic is andropause, right? You know, how to balance hormones in men that seem to have low testosterone. And it might be like the vitamin D thing where we just start testing more men for this and finding that many, many people are low in testosterone. But one of the mechanisms of how we think that the testosterone is low is that all the stress hormones steal the precursor materials that would normally go to the testosterone pathway, and it goes to the stress pathway. So dealing with stress is very important, and we could practice meditation and yoga and mind-body work, but I think herbs play a big role in that. And I know the Eclectics did lots of work on some of the most fascinating herbs for helping people to relax. Why don't you comment on your favorite ones for the listeners?
Well, I think everyone's maybe heard about valerian, which is a common herb that smells very good, and you can grow it in your garden, and it's very effective. Francis, Dr. Brinker, and I work together a lot, and we get questions pretty often on the phone for different conditions similar to what you're asking me. And a lot of times what we do is just go simply to, like, food and having a good diet. I'm sure you understand that. Mm-hmm. And I need to explain it to your listeners, too, a little bit. It's just that there's a lot. Eating correctly has a lot to do with wellness and sometimes changing these hormones that you're mentioning and so forth. And we make sure that everybody's understanding that consistency of eating berries, for instance, seems to be very popular these days, blueberries, and making sure that these foods are getting into the system and in enhancing health in general and building that foundation. When you think about using some of the extracts and the tinctures and things, the ones that are pretty effective and you can certainly try are just chamomile. Right now you can probably walk out into any garden almost anywhere in the United States and find someone, a friend, has some chamomile growing in their yard. And when you look at common books on herbs, chamomile is almost always there for stress relaxation. Another one, and sometimes, as I mentioned earlier, something about some plants being fresh are more effective than when they're dried, and that's true. So sometimes you don't always have to dry the herb. You might try just making up a tea or something, not a cold tea, of just the fresh plant material and drinking that if you like it. So another one is lemon balm. Lemon balm is pretty easy to grow. It's not as common as chamomile, but in its fresh form, it's very effective for any kind of memory, and that kind of ties into anxiety as well. And then, of course, if you look in any herbal book at all, you'll find a long list of other herbs that can be used for nervous condition, and sometimes different ones will work better than that one. So you might try two or three different kinds, and that might work better for your type of stress than the one that works for other people. So it's one thing to have, you know, a diagnosis and get a more direct use of an herb versus something casually for relaxation, and then of course just staying focused on what is causing the stress. As physicians, we all know this, and we tell the patient that too, that what is causing the stress and eliminate that stress. And sometimes just having a good diet will start to eliminate the stress. So Dr. Brinker and I never cease to encourage people to not forget that good health is important, and then the herbs will only be enhanced by anything added to that diet too.
Well, you know, it's interesting with stress and sometimes even how it ties into insomnia. I've actually seen that using the using some of the herbs throughout the day as a tea, and then maybe taking a little bit of a dose prior to going to bed, seems to be a more effective strategy than taking all the herbs before bed. I guess it's because you're kind of keeping the stress hormones and neurotransmitters and whatnot modulated throughout the day and not allowing them to kind of really usurp the body. And so, yeah, putting a, I like that idea of using the teas throughout the day. We drink all kinds of tea, and of course now we're making sun tea and iced tea, and people could use these herbs instead of, you know, the more caffeinated things that are available in the sugar-laden caffeinated things that are available at the stores and whatnot. Any gas station you pull up to, it's crazy, the the garbage beverages that are out there. And it's funny because sometimes they put a little bit of herbs in them and they and they kind of beguile the consumer into thinking that they're getting really an herbal thing. But so you find that teas, even though they're considered the weakest of the botanicals, are very effective ways of approaching herbal medicine.
Well, yeah, I think there's no such thing as a necessarily a weak herb. It's maybe more so how it's processed or how it's not processed very well. So if it's been dried for a long time, then you make a tea out of it. It's really not going to be very effective, probably, because it's gotten old. So you got to be aware of that. That's the main thing. So you really kind of want to have them, and the fresher the better. But sometimes, you know, and I can't, you know, go without mentioning that the water inside a plant is very potent. And if you have plants that have water in them, those plants have actually taken the water from the soil and brought it up through their roots. And then, as we probably heard when we were in school, we've heard about photosynthesis, where the plants actually split that water that comes up through the roots. And in doing that, they turn the H2O that comes up through the roots into hydrogen oxygen as separate items. So it's been split. So it's no longer H2O. It's now H and then OH as well. So it's been split into a new molecule, and it rejoins with other water that's been split, and those turn into new molecules. So plants make brand new water that's never been anywhere in the world except inside that plant at that moment from the act of photosynthesis. So don't underestimate the power of plants simply because they also contain new water, which is from photosynthesis. Not many people know this, but it's common knowledge if you read anything about botany and look at the biology of photosynthesis. It's there. And the information is there. And we kind of take that for granted. We completely take this for granted because I don't think anyone knows this to any degree. We've kind of overlooked this issue. So plants by themselves, just by the act of photosynthesis, are very powerful materials. And I know most people probably don't think water is very powerful, but it's not. I want to encourage people to just think about that. And this is part of as the profession grows and we grow as naturopaths, we focus on these type of things that no one is really looking at. But historically, as you have mentioned several times in this discussion, a lot of these early eclectic people from the 1840s have been working on these botanicals and extensively, and they were rich people in knowledge and science. And a lot of their information is completely accurate. This is not something that's just been brought up recently, and it continues to go. And part of Eclectic Institute is our real focus is in cultivating these plant materials, and we have a 70-acre field now of plants here in Sandy, Oregon, and we just purchased another 85 acres of land next door to that. So we're continuing to focus on growing the materials, and those materials are very important. So when people are trying different remedies and they're trying different forms of them, if for some reason they may believe it should work and it doesn't work, well, try a different one or try something else, and that one might work. Not everything that is sold, like you mentioned, in markets and gas stations and so on, is that effective? And so I wouldn't put, you know, that aside until you've really kind of give it a better chance.
Now, as more people become interested in herbal medicine, clearly, you know, the challenge is providing really good quality herbal medicine for the populace. How's your company contributing to that? It's interesting because I know you guys are pioneers in doing different things, and you're also still keeping the older, bringing the older information into that. So, and then, you know, the other question that follows up is, you know, if we're growing the herbs in a farm type of thing, how is that different from, you know, kind of wildcrafting the herbs in the woods or whatnot?
When I mentioned stinging nettles earlier about its effectiveness for allergies, and that was never really known until we accidentally discovered it,
yeah,
we had collected that material in the wild, and we still collect it in the wild. Now, we have a farm, like I just mentioned, and we can, when we've got nettles growing wild in the farm, actually, and so it's very possible for us to take and grow nettles organically at the farm. But we found originally that it works so well in the wild that we've continued to just harvest it in the wild. And here in Oregon, there's plenty of nettles to find.
No scarcity of nettles, right?
No. So there's no real purpose of growing it organically. But some people, you know, think organic is the end result. But that's not really true. If you collect things in the wild, you usually, and you know who's collecting it and how they're collecting it, and that it and that they've done it over and over and over again. So they're very experienced at it. And they're also concerned about the environment and, you know, all the things that you think about, then there's really, I think, the wild plants are much better suited than growing organically in general. But if you get one grown in the wild and harvest it correctly and one grown organically and done correctly, both of those are going to be very potent.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't worry about that so much. There's no one's completely better than the other. But it's more important to really kind of pay attention to, if you're getting a product or using a product and it's packaged, you should pay a little more attention to how that is brought about and understand that there are some can be a lot better than others, and it takes a little bit of investigation to start to have a few questions to ask about everything and be open to asking more questions about things and getting more answers. We encourage that. I do, because I like to garden, and like you do, and you just use your sense about questions about things that you would grow in your own garden and eat. You should ask the same things about the herbs you're buying.
Right. They should be, you know, you have to focus. I know as a farmer, focusing on the health of the soil is really paramount. It's hard to control the health of the air. I mean, I guess you try your best to, you know, farm in a place away from urban. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are going back to the farm, even in urban places. And so, you know, they may have some issues with uptake of heavy metals and pollution, but, you know, I applaud at least they're kind of getting back to keeping farming and local farming and herbal medicine traditions alive. And I think that's really important. But, you know, like I mentioned, I know there's no scarcity in nettles, but, you know, as more and more people get into this, I don't know. I mean, we have to have bigger and better, I guess, facilities to create this important amount of the herbs that are out there and preparations because, you know, as more people get into herbal medicine, and it's not just kind of like a fad, we have to have good sources. So, you know, the temptation is to get into mass production of plants, but that runs into so many problems. I mean, you know, Connecticut's one of the first states to ban GMOs, for instance. You know, I know they're working with a full ban if some of the other New England states join in. But these are the types of things that, you know, is not really a line with a more naturopathic philosophy of herbal products. And, you know, when we see the modern herbal products out there, there's advantages and disadvantages of using them, especially if they're mass-produced. You know, like if you go to a Chinese herbal store, for instance, in Portland or in New York, and you buy some Chinese herbs, you're not really sure if that Chinese herb was fertilized with sewage. So there is a political, like the late Bill Mitchell said, this movement towards natural medicine is definitely a political science because we have to solve some of the Earth's problems with supply and demand and proper growing of things. Any comments on that, Dr. Alsted?
Well, it's never ending, and I think one of the issues that we're all concerned about now is bees, honeybees in particular, and bumblebees and all kinds of bees. And these contribute a lot to the environment, and without the bees, we wouldn't even be talking much about herbs because there wouldn't be any herbs.
Right.
So it's all tied in. The GMOs, of course, are related. Not only is the GMOs, but it's the people who don't think much about bees and produce the GMOs in the first place. The whole picture has to be brought together. And if you're going to do GMOs, what are you doing about bees? And forget about GMOs. If they're not doing anything about bees, there's a whole other problem that's emerging from that lack of thought in general. When we all get back to the same space about this, maybe we'll all, you know, start to think differently. In the meantime, we're all trying to battle it as best we can. And I think if people really get attached more to agriculture and more toward the plant material and growing it and seeing what it takes a lot of work. I'm impressed more and more by my grandparents' diligence when they were growing things in southern Illinois, where they, when they migrated from Europe, eventually came to Illinois. How hard that is to do. And when Eclectic is growing these plant materials, it's not easy. And we're not growing everything that we sell. I would find that pretty difficult to be able to accomplish that. So I think the more we support the general trend toward naturopathy, toward agriculture, toward the whole picture, and toward honeybees and so forth, then we're starting to get it together. And when we include that in our diet and the way we eat in general, and not just assume that, you know, sometimes it's okay, and then why am I sick, and then, oh, it's, I didn't take the right herb or something like that. Well, it's the whole picture, and it all will come together, and it does come together. It's just not always a magic bullet.
So you don't really see, you know, and this is kind of like a rhetorical question almost, you don't really see herbs replacing drugs and things like that. You know, that's not very naturopathic thinking, but, you know, herbal preparations really aren't designed, I don't think, personally, to replace drugs. A lot of people apply herbal medicine. We call it, I guess, in our profession, like a green allopath. Like, you know, take St. John's wort if you have depression, you know, instead of Prozac or whatever. But that's not the philosophy. So why don't we end on you could talk a little bit about naturopathic philosophy and include the herbal, your own herbal philosophy in there.
Well, I began as a pharmacist, and I worked as a regular retail pharmacist for 7 years in California and didn't see anyone getting better. And so that was why I left, was because I was going like, well, I'm going to be under the same conditions. I'm going to have the same things being given to me as I get older, as I'm seeing that I'm handing out over the counter. So I had found at that time a book on the Naturopathic College in Oregon, and I wrote up there, and I got the letter back, said no such address. So I thought, okay, this doesn't even exist. So I had to follow up even more. I was lucky. I found somebody who lived there, sent them the letter. They sent it to the college. The college wrote me back and said, yeah, there's a college here. And so I went to it. But that was my individual step. I had to take that and remove myself from drugs and pharmacy and so on. And they're effective. They're definitely not. But they're not the whole picture. They're part of the picture. And I don't think that we can rely on herbs being the whole picture, and I don't think we can rely on drugs being part of that. So we have to work together. But as you get healthier in general, which is most of what I've brought up in today, is you will start to feel better, and you will start to feel more confident about things. But it is something that one thing, even drugs, are not going to do the entire job in some cases. So we also have to sometimes switch doctors, and we have to do this, and we have to do that. So just as we do in the regular medical profession with changing our approaches sometimes because things aren't working, we sometimes have to do that with drugs, with herbs, but we also have to use herbs and give them a chance too. So I've just through the years of removed myself from pharmacy and growing these herbs and having this company and running this company entirely, I find that it is effective, and it takes a little bit of thought and work toward it, and gradually it gives you an option.
Yeah, well, I agree with that as a practitioner. It's funny, but I was going to say when you were finding out information about the college, there was no internet back then, so it was a struggle, and you had to be very dedicated and to kind of go through and find these gems. But herbal medicine, I think, is part of a broader scope of naturopathic healing. And it's funny because I got into naturopathic medicine because I was interested in herbal medicine, but boy, when I went to school and learned about hydrotherapy and fasting and proper eating and nutrition and mind-body things, Eastern medicine, I was just blown away by the whole philosophy and scope of practice in trying to prevent and treat conditions. But with that, we have to end. I'm looking at the time. It's been a pleasure having you. Give us your website so people can get more information on your work and Eclectic Institute.
Oh, the website is eclectic.com. Eclectic.com.
Great. Yeah. All right, Dr. Alistair, it's nice to catch up with you again.
Thank you, Eugene.
I remember years ago having a nice conversation on Passion Flower at some conference somewhere, but... We'll talk soon again.
Many miles. Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, take care, Ed. Bye-bye. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Wishing you, everyone, the best of health and stay healthy. It's better to stay healthy and than to wait till you're sick, like we've been saying the whole hour. Bye-bye. See you later.